Now let's get back to relativity. Just a recap of what I did yesterday. So I used linearized relativity, basically around flat background, flat metric, Minkowski metric. And then I did some kind of like magic fix mixing, gauge fixing. And from there, I extracted the actual two physical degrees of freedom for relativity. Now, I just wanted to make a couple of comments just so you have a good picture of what is going on. Similar to electromagnetism, fixing gauges basically helps you do the calculations in a way that you can track your actual degrees of freedom. So there is nothing that is inherent physics about this thing. It's just the kind of way that makes things clear for us. Calculation and extract physics. Physics or observables, thing like that. So the physics doesn't depend on the gauge. So I used one gauge yesterday, like the harmonic gauge, and I showed how nicely I can see the two independent degrees of freedom for relativity. And the rest I can always fix, they're not physical, but I could have chosen a different gauge and the physics should have been the same. Or once I do my calculation, I could change the gauge. The physics is invariant. And in fact, in a lot of, depending on the problem, you choose the gauge that is best suited for your calculation or understanding the physics. That's why if I'm doing cosmology, I prefer different gauges. Numerical relativity is my prefer a different gauge. It, you kind of adapt to the thing that is best for your calculation. So that's one comment about yesterday. And in tutorial today, we will redo the calculation in the light cone gauge, but at the end of the day, you see you will get to, in fact, the same polarization for gravitons. Okay? Just to give a picture of what we are doing now. Now, back to linearized theory. Once again, I'm going to write the Einstein theory, Einstein equations, assuming I have only perturbation, linear perturbation around Minkowski. I have fixed the gauge to the Donder gauge, not necessarily traceless. But I have made it transverse. Okay. So this is my equation. This is the constraint I am allowed to use. But the trace is, I haven't done that like yesterday. Now, yesterday I was looking at vacuum solutions to get the wave nature of the story. Now, today I want to look at something like, you know, similar to electromagnetism. So, okay, I get how the waves propagate in the vacuum, but what sources them? Can I figure out if I can use this approximation to calculate sourcing the emission of gravitational wave? So to do that, I'm going to make other approximations. So I'm going to assume I have some object very far away from me when we are making observation. Let's say the center, whatever, use one point in the object, can be center of mass, but it's, if it's oscillating, then that might move, but I pick one point there, and I call this distance to be R, in fact, it's spatial. So the object is there, I make the observation there. Now, this has a distribution of energy momentum density. So depending on what goes on around here, the right-hand side of this thing gets source, which I want to measure what is the h mu nu that this person on Earth measures. At this location. So it would be T and R. Sourced by T mu nu here, and the rest is vacuum. Let's say the size of this thing is D overall on average, and D is, again, it's a far away approximation. D is much less than R. The magnitude norm of R. So what else? So therefore, any point that I take here, R prime, this will also be much smaller than by this approximation. Which by that I mean this. Okay. Can I solve this equation now? This equation given these approximations. Well, actually just this equation by itself. Yeah, no. Yes.
It's a wave equation, so I can find a Green's function.
Exactly. And the Green function that I would use here, I'm gonna use the retarded Green function. Because I'm assuming the wave is being emitted here and coming to me, not from the future, right? So I will use that one to calculate h mu nu. So h mu nu is going to be, the pi's canceled, 4 pi's. So I only get 4 g. Now I have to do an integration over the whole object. Let's say the object is sigma, volume of the object, dr prime, 3D integration over the T that emission happened, which is the T retarded. At R prime, distance, so if it's getting, for example, sourced by this point, so this would be, sorry, it's curved, but think of it as a straight line. So this would be R minus R prime. So the distance is norm of that. Right. So to calculate this at T and R, I need to evaluate this integration. Agree? Tom? Is that okay? Does that make sense?
I can see very well
from here. Okay. You? Prabal? Okay, so now what do I do? What is TR? TR is the time that it takes, that emission happened. So it's basically T minus the time that it took light to travel there. So TR is t minus, take the speed of light to be 1, so r minus r prime, right? Now let's I'm gonna now estimate r minus r prime. So I'm gonna use linear algebra. So if I calculate the norm of this, it will be r squared plus r prime squared plus the cross term. So no, sorry, 1r, 1r prime. I take r out. Plus this. Which I'm, when I don't put the arrow, I mean just norm. Okay, so now in my approximation, this is much smaller than that. So that's the second order in R. So to leading order, I'm just gonna keep this and this. In fact, I'm gonna very soon even drop that one. So just keep the zeroth order and show that the zeroth order contribution to obtain the gravitational waves. So if that's the case, then R minus R prime is simply R times, now Taylor expanding that would be 1 minus, right, half of this, so half of that. I haven't made a mistake. And there was a R squared here too. Right? Correct me if I'm not, I make a mistake. So in my notes I have apparently. Now to leading or, no, that's correct, right? The 2 drops out because I get a 1/2. So therefore 1 over r minus r prime is 1 over r. The inverse of this is 1 plus r r prime r squared. So, interesting enough, I don't know, in my notes I have the 2, but I must have made a mistake. Okay, so now I also have TR here, which also depends on R minus R prime. So now I'm ready to practically expand this thing out. So before that, I'm gonna expand T as well. So T mu nu of TR R prime will be, there is a R here. So first I have to do the this. So let's see. I replace that by this thing. So it would be T of T minus r plus this is r prime r comma r prime. So I just substituted for this for tr, so, and I plugged in this, right? Yeah. Okay, so once again, if this is very small, of order of d over r, right? Then I can expand this in terms of this as well. So then I need to take the time derivative, derivative with respect to the first variable, to do the Taylor expansion. So it will be T at capital T at T, and there were mu nu's that I have to carry on, mu nu minus r at r prime plus the first term in after Taylor expanding, which is t dot, the time derivative, which is your partial derivative with respect to this t. Again, in linear astrometry, I think they're the same, to zeroth order. So mu nu r prime times this piece, delta x or delta t in this case, so which is times r squared. Okay. So now going forward, I want to drop all the first order, just keep the leading ones as well. So ignore this, ignore all of this everywhere. Now, the reason I want to argue and justify to do this is that if the changes, so let's see, we are talking about how much energy density changes in d amount of time, which is in the speed of like how much light travels from one side to the other side. So if in that time scale t is not changing as much, or the frequency of the change of this thing is much smaller than, let's say this has a frequency of, it's fluctuating or oscillating with omega frequency. So therefore, this is of order of omega t, and this thing is of order of, compare the relative strength of this compared to this one. Therefore, is this term, right? So I would get, did I?
So it'll be over r squared, or over r.
There we go, that's what I, yes. So now it makes sense. Good. So then I have something of order of, because then the r's cancels, it's of order of, less than of order of d to the r, right? So can I cancel t dot times this? So let's see, t dot is of order of that. So t dot times d is of order of this. Now if I want to, d times d, not, let's write it this way so it's more clear. So t dot d will become of order of omega t, as in energy momentum tensor, times d. If I want to ignore that term compared to the leading order, I want this to be less than t itself. So as long as omega d, the frequency of the oscillation of t, is much less than 1, this approximation should hold. And what is another way to think about it is you can take W to other side and say, as long as the periodicity of the change of this object oscillating is much larger than the time that it takes for light to travel along the object, width of the object, that's okay. So basically, the wavelength of the change is much larger than the size of the object. Then you can do this. Does that make sense? Okay. Now I'm gonna also make a remark. So David's note follows this calculation in Fourier transform in time. So you immediately write all of these things in terms of W's and in Fourier frequencies. I'm gonna do it in real space. The result in the end shouldn't depend on whether you do it in Fourier or real. The reason I want to do it in Fourier is because I want to also show you that the zero mod thing in the Fourier, which is basically the limit that W goes to zero, also gives us the Newtonian potential. In the Fourier, you have to be careful because then you're dividing by one over omegas. And then if omega is zero, you have to be careful. So that's why I prefer to do it this way. And this is here, therefore, I'm following the notes by Daniel Bauman, which I already put the link in the outline to. So if you want, you can check it out. Okay, so given all of this, now I'm ready, I think, to estimate back H mu nu. So H mu nu at T and R to leading order, or the first term that should appear, should be integration of the R that I had in denominator, the first thing comes out. And maybe I need the hockey stick, right? So that thing that was here, I just keep this term. So that comes out. It doesn't depend on integration over R prime here. That's fixed, so that comes out. Then I'm saying, well, for this one also, just keep this term. So I'm almost done, right? So this is, therefore, just dr prime over the object, this isolated far away object, t mu nu, t minus r, r prime. Right? Make sense? W with me? Okay, so now it's very easy to see, for example, let's do H00, because you did that in the Newtonian limit. And you know, in that case, going from the actual H to this, the trace, and take, there's a trace difference. You take that into account. There you arrived at actual H00 was negative 2 phi, I think. But then when you calculated this, you had, or maybe that one was 2 phi, this one is minus 4 phi. So now if I do this, I get I need to integrate over T00. And this is kind of now, and I'm gonna be, again, at going forward in this lecture, a little bit we are sloppy, we are making approximation. So this is, you can call it mass or energy of this isolated object. If you are, for example, asymptotically flat, everything holds, but defining mass and energy in GR is a tricky business. So, but in this case, it's kind of like the energy of the this object. I'm integrating its zero, zero component, and it seems if it's non-relativistic, this is the same as mass. So therefore, I arrive at this being, so 4 g m over r. Which is, I think, what you had from Poisson equations. Okay. Now, let's move on to the other ones, because the gravitational wave is not in this one. It's in HIJ components. You can do the 0i as well. So 0i, that kind of gives you a momentum of the object. So if it does, if it's zero, it's not moving, or like the distribution, those are zero, then the pi will be zero. So h0i in that thing would be zero. H bar 0i would be zero. Now, let's, however, go for hij. So I still have 4g over r. Now I need to do this. Prime tij. Now I'm gonna do algebraic tricks to get show that for radiation, gravitational radiation, you need the quadrupole moment of the object. So let's see how we can get there. First, notice here I'm doing the lower cases, lower indices. But let's take a look at the upper indices. If I have Tij, it's symmetrized. So it's the same as Aj, right? Or half of it, or two of it. So you can always, you have to track the T's, right? This is two of it, right? No. One half, it is the same, right? Okay, then, but then, let's see if I can do this. Also, I can do this trick. I'm gonna say, I can multiply this by some r prime j, or let's take this k, r prime j. So multiply it by x, but then take the partial derivative. So this is ik, but I multiply it by this. If I take the partial derivative by j, I get a term that leaves me this. So basically, if I did this, now let's see, does it work? Because this, one of the terms gives me tk over this partial derivative of r prime j, that gives me a delta, and then I contract it with this, it gives me delta ij. And but then there will be another term which is partial derivative of this, so I have to subtract it. So let's see. Does it work? This trick? So you take the partial derivative of this, it gives you two terms. One is this, which I'm subtracting. It gives you another term, which is Cik, k r prime of j. But this is delta j k. So this makes this Tij, right? So it brings back Tij. Okay. So I use this trick. Now, what does that help me with? Well, now that I have... Okay, but this is good. Because if I put this back in this integration, this is a boundary term, it's a divergence term. So I don't care about it. The thing I need, I basically can convert this to calculating this negative of this. It's like a, right? So this becomes negative of, and let's not do it yet, substitute back, but it will be a total derivative minus that. Now, let's look at this also. This is kind of like the energy momentum conservation, except that it's missing something. What is it missing? What? The covariant? Yeah. Well, I am in the linearized theory. So this thing is already of order of h. So the covariant derivative doesn't, which is something we come back to it. So, which we have to keep in mind, actually, in back of our mind, when I'm doing this, I'm assuming this thing is of order of weak field approximation, of order of this. So therefore, and this is a side note, right? Because if I'm saying, well, you can calculate this and it is g of m over r, that means I am in the limit that m over r must be much less than one to be consistent with my right theory. So this is a good calculation as long as this is a small. It's almost good for pulsars and stuff, but obviously for black holes, I'm breaking this approximation. So that's why we need numerical relativity. Right. So it's not that, but it is related. Go ahead.
Can't you just change covariant derivatives to partial here, only in Cartesian system? Because if you are in another coordinate system, you will have terms in your connection that are zero or.
Yeah, but then when I'm yes, then you're right. When I, that's true. Let me think. Is it true? You're saying if you go to on a sphere, then in that case you have to be Christoffel symbol give you non-zero thing, and then therefore when you do the derivative there, you got to be careful if you're doing it on a surface of a sphere. So, but yeah, in this case I'm using that eta mu nu plus Minkowski, but I have to be careful with that, right? I think so, yeah, because the Riemann is zero, no matter which coordinate I calculate it. But the gammas are not zero, right? Yeah, so. Okay, but what I was going after was the same thing as you were saying, except that now with this, at least in the Cartesian coordinate, the conservation of T mu nu is something like this. So even if I put K, this would be zero. But I'm talking about ij, and when I did this, I just these are spatial vectors, so these j's are only spatial, so it's 1, 2, 3. Same with this, same with this k. So it's missing the zero part. In other words, this is giving me zero t zero k plus, and actually I'm doing it on I, so I. K T zero I K, and let's put them all in the same side. I zero. Does that make sense? Because it's symmetric, it doesn't matter. Okay. So my point is, some of these two are zero. So therefore, this thing is negative of that thing. I can plug it in. So this becomes the partial. The divergence thing minus, but then there is a minus here, I get plus. So it becomes zero T zero I times I prime J. That makes sense? It's trick. I'm gonna do one more trick. What's the last trick? So now I'm gonna do the symmetrization. definition of, not that actually, another one. So T zero I, I'm going after calculating this thing now. So I will say, well, plus that R prime J. If I had this symmetrized with J, then I could once again use my partial derivative tricks, write it, and we're gonna see if it works or not, as partial derivative of the whole thing times a new R. So add a partial derivative. Same, almost similar to what I did here, except now your I is zero. Your, this other one is I. So that goes to here. And then multiply by J. Add a total derivative or divergence in this way. Now, if you do that, if you take the K derivative, partial derivative of, this is prime, again, we are talking about the object, I would get a delta IK, and then that delta gives me, so one of the terms gives me exactly T0ij, but there will also be two other terms. One is the derivative with respect to j, which gives me a delta jk. I get one. And the last one is the derivative of this, which is, I think I'm heading for that, gives me that. So let's write it down. So there will be the partial derivative of T0k. And does that make sense? Am I missing something? So let's see, what am I? This is it. But there will be another time, but let's do it together. So if I do the partial derivative of this, this will be, one of them is obviously that, okay, zero. But there will be another term. One will become T0k delta I k I prime j plus another one zero k r prime I delta k j. And this is therefore goes over this, it becomes T zero I R prime J, this becomes T zero K, K and this J R prime I, yes. And therefore, this is the symmetrized version of this, right? And there is that other one that is partial derivative of that, which I am canceling off. Who is confused at this point? Does that make sense or not? So I replaced this by a total derivative minus this term. And I'm saying because if I dis this total derivative, there will be the derivative of this times these two term, which I subtract because I don't have it on the left. And there will be a partial derivative of r prime I. That gives me a delta ik, partial derivative of r prime j, delta jk. Then you contract the k's, it becomes t0i, t0j, but that's the, and then one half, that's the definition of symmetrization that I need on the left. So the two are the same. That makes sense? We don't have to erase it. Okay. I think now I'm ready to therefore take this. Symmetrize this. So if I do symmetrize this, I will have two of these things, total derivative, I don't care. But the symmetrization of this and symmetrization of that thing would give me the symmetrization of, let's see, if I take, what am I doing here? Right, this is exactly, so this is it the same as this? Yes. Mod times ri, right? So if I multiply that to ri and symmetrize it, should be getting this. Help me here. Let's see. So Tij, which I started, we'll forget about the total derivatives, is now equal to from the first, second line, is T0i r prime j symmetrized plus the total derivatives. And then this thing, oh, right, because the time derivative of r prime is zero, so it can be the whole thing or just this. That's what I was confused about. So therefore, total derivative of that is the total derivative of this thing. Substituted. How am I doing my time? Okay, I think we can do it. So I have this. And so from there, I take the 0i. So this thing is equal to, I have to take another time derivative, right? So time derivative of this, and then this I substitute from there, which is once again more thing plus substituting this over. So 1/2 of partial derivative with zero, then substitute in this. Let's see, do I have everything? So Tij is a partial derivative times this. I symmetrize it, I get two parentheses. So becomes partial derivative of that. Now from I plug in for this thing, there's gonna be some total derivative, which I don't care, minus this term. So I put the whole thing inside substituting for here. So I substituted it, plugged it in. There was a 1/2, and there was this whole thing, right? This is the green thing. And it was summed. There is no symmetrization anymore, is there? I think it's not, right, because it's already symmetry. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Is there a response to what in that
part? Which one? So I'm still calculating this.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, what I need is Tij down, but I'm saying let's calculate Tij up. Tij up, I use just algebraic tricks to use it at the total rate minus this term. And then so this is now, then I use the conservation of momentum to turn it into this thing. Now there is a r prime j, but times this. Forget about the time derivative. So just calculate T0i r prime j, which I did here. So T prime I j is this whole thing, this second term. Now, once I have it, I have to do the additional time derivative on it.
Okay, so it should be minus 1/2.
Is there a minus I'm missing?
And the derivative, I mean, k is acting just on t, right?
Minus. So let's see. Here I had minus. So when I substitute it here, you're right, I might get a minus here. Right, so there's a minus. Although I'm a little bit confused why I don't have it in my notes, but actually you're right, it's there. And then what else?
The derivative k is acting just on t, right?
The derivative, yes. And this one, well, I don't have to put this one because the zero to this is another make, doesn't give me anything, right? So, thank you. Okay, not done yet. I think this is the last one though. Now, once again, I have this thing, which we already dealt with it last time. I thought, in fact, I had substituted it, but, right? So I had, no, I didn't do the zero one. I did the I one, right? I used this one to go there, but I'm going to use the conservation of momentum one more time to now even remove k and turn it into zero. So one more time, conservation of momentum for ti. For T0 mu 0, let's see, which one do I want to, TK plus T0 should be zero. So then I should be able to take this out and put the negative of that. So therefore I get the total derivative piece plus 1/2 of, now this becomes another partial derivative in time t 0, 0. Again, this is time derivative. You can separate it from. Okay. Now I define the quadrupole moment. So the moment of truth. Finally, I have everything I want. So right now, I have arrived at the fact that h mu nu will only depend on this thing, when I do the integration, because these total derivatives drop out. So let's define quadrupole moment, this object, at some retarded time. Keep in mind, this Tij is being calculated at T minus R. So retarded time of the center that I'm measuring from. So I'm gonna call that T, I think the TR, I use T capital R used for there, but let's say T minus R is the retarded from here, right? So, or just write it as is, right? Little r. So this is T minus R. Is defined as taking the 3D integration over the object of its T00 at T minus R and R prime times R prime J, R prime I. Call it quadrupole moment. And finally, we have our HIJ, because now it depends only on this thing. So I substitute this back into the integration. I have almost everything here except 2-time derivative of it. And therefore, H bar ij at T and R is going to be 4g over R times we had that, right? The whole thing. Integration over sigma dr prime cubed 1 half partial derivative or time derivative of t00 tr r prime I r prime j, which is basically, I have 1/2 here, so it becomes 2g over r. And this thing, the rest of it becomes, I have time derivative of ij at tr. Okay, that's it. And yeah. You managed to do it. Now, so one thing you see is that I need obviously a time dependent, T mean u, T zero zero at least, and this, in fact, the quadrupole to be time dependent in order to source Hij. If you write it back to, and this is interesting because it's not like electromagnetism, it's not dipole radiation, it's quadrupole radiation. And if you do this in Fourier in time, which you get David's formula, then in frequency space, you get 2-time derivative of this. So it's omega squared e to the I omega r, the oscillations, it goes as 1 over r, the strength of the wave drops with 1 over r, which also I think is interesting because it's kind of, you probably get to it in April if you take a strong gravity course. It helps us in some way in observation, because unlike the flux of brightness and things that drop as 1 over r squared, it's dropping at least weaker. So with gravitational wave, at least you have that advantage. Even though it's much smaller, but there's one thing going for you. Now, let's say you have, again, I cannot technically use my calculation directly for black hole case, I think, because I made that assumption that M over R is still linear. But it is, at least intuitively, work even there that you need a quadrupole moment to produce it. But you will do a more advanced thorough calculation, hopefully, in April if you take that course. But for pulsars and other binary systems, this should be a good approximation. And I think this is the kind of thing that was used, at least according to David notes, in 1970 when they made the first observation of, indirect observation of gravitational wave from pulsars and got the Nobel by Taylor and Hans. I think one of them was here some years ago and gave a nice talk about how they did that discovery, or someone who was very close to them. But just to give you the also a strength of gravitational waves, so if you have two things, if these two, the ones that we are seeing in LIGO, the first one that was observed, we were dealing with 30 solar masses, and then they merged. And if you do the math, if like this, one of them was 30 solar mass, the other one's 36. So when they merged, the total mass of the final object was 62. So around 3 solar mass was lost in the process in terms of gravitational waves, which is very interesting because that's more radiation than all of the stars in visible universe. And it was only like fraction, a very extreme fraction of a second. So they do emit energy, or the waves come to us. That's my point. But I want to discuss less is calculating that energy is not as clear cut as you might think. Again, for this kind of problem, if linearized theory is almost a good approximation, far away object, lower mass, flat, asymptotic, all of this thing, most of the calculation holds and we can rely on them. Things become much messier if you are in different kind of backgrounds and other effects. But let me give you a break and then we can discuss that a little bit. Yes.
So, which boundary term goes in there? Is it the sensor
to which boundary condition for?
We have several boundary terms that we drop out because I assume some of them go to zero at the boundary. Is this
Sensor? Well, it kind of goes back to our issue of gauges, I think. Right? Let me think. Because you're saying, well, when. Where is my integration here? Let's say I put, this was the first term that I'm dropping. So then it becomes calculating the flux. Let's see, it becomes calculating this on the surface, right? So that would be the flux of Ti times R. Times n, and So I don't, I have to think about it, but on top of my head, but I think as long as the material is not leaking out as much and you're assuming it's almost contained in there, those terms then would go to zero. Because one of them I can see, for example, if it was zero I, that would be kind of like a flux of T mu nu out of the object. But this one, if, right, let's see. If I take diagonalized one, so I have TII, then it would be change of pressure times RJ, some kind of like change. Yeah, I can't do it in my head, but I have to think about it. But I think that we have to make some kind of assumption about the flux of energy density around.
The
boundary of
the object, the pressure is zero.
So
if it was not zero, it would expand.
Exactly, yeah. I think, yeah, in this approximation, we are ignoring all of those. Yeah. Yeah.
Like for shear, it's the same. Shear.
Yeah. Exactly, that makes sense to me. That the off diagonal ones would be the shear ones, and the diagonal ones would be the pressure ones, and so on. Yeah, good point. Okay.
In that equation right below, the zero shouldn't be symmetrized, right?
This one is not symmetrized?
Yeah.
Let's see. You're right. You don't need it, right? Because, well, no, I need, do I need it? Because I want, I wrote this as this. So this is.
The zero shouldn't be in the bracket. Because otherwise you'd have another two.
Oh, yes, that's a typo, yes. Yeah. And does the rest hold off? Yeah, because I have the 1/2. The 1/2 goes there. Yeah.
And then you say, oh, I just need this.
Okay, so now I want to discuss a little bit how the gravitational wave carry energy or power, and how do we calculate it? Can we define, now that I have this wave, can I define an energy momentum tensor for it? What's at stake here? So everything I built up so far, I'm gonna give you some motivation, and I'm gonna warn you that my discussion is gonna be a little bit hand wavy, because the whole topic is a lot of like debatable issues in it. And again, as I said, in some problem settings, you might be able to address it better. In some cases, it's not that easy. In fact, my whole PhD thesis was on a similar issue. It kind of has to do with the back reaction effect in and nonlinear effects in general relativity, which is not as much of a settled problem as you think it is. Reaction and what I was working on back then was, for example, in cosmology we use linear theory, but we also have the dark energy problem. Could this back reaction resolve that? And there were some calculations, and I spent my whole like PhD program to go through all of these and show that a lot of those calculations were in fact gauge artifact, and like inflation in the early time cannot give us dark energy or back react enough to solve the cosmological constant problem. But that was in different context. I want to say it's a similar issue here, and it's kind of because we know that general relativity, as we wrote it down, is a nonlinear theory. So the linearized theory is not totally a consistent theory when we write it down. Therefore, you've got to be very careful what is physical, what is gauge when you go beyond nonlinear. In this particular case, I built up a case. I solved for gravitational wave yesterday. I said, well, these are the waves, these are the solutions. I'm kind of showing that how they, if you can source them with a distant object. Now, what is the energy, for example, in electromagnetism? You can calculate E squared plus B squared, which is the derivative of the potential. Is the same thing here true? That I can come up with some energy density for gravitational waves and say, well, it's going to be some derivative of the potential or the wave squared. Does that carry energy? And I try to say, well, you can, but you got to be careful on it, because if I do that, obviously, intrinsically, as you see, this is a second order object in H, but I was building the whole thing on a first order calculation, linear calculation, and then also this was a metric perturbation. The first derivative is not a tensorial object, right? Because you have gamma mu nu, and then how does it work? Like to get to energy momentum tensor, you often get the second derivatives. Therefore, I'm gonna argue there are different schemes to do this calculation, and I'm gonna just outline one of these approaches, the back reaction approach, which again, as I said, works in some cases. So I will not do all the calculations here, so no worries, just as long as you get the idea, and then write the final formula that you may need at least for hand wavy calculation of getting the energy loss. So in my example yesterday, I assumed wave is propagating in the vacuum. Therefore, Einstein equations were on right-hand side, there was no source. I also assumed the metric was perturbative around flat. So I added some term. Now let's keep, now I'm gonna add this epsilon as in like my keeping track of my orders. So like if I assume there is like a first order correction, but there could in potential, I mean there is probably set, if I wanted to solve for the whole nonlinear theory, there could be second order corrections, right? And more. So I have, I'm going a little bit beyond linear. So then these corrections I expect to be, if I take this of order of h, this would be of order of h squared in other ways. Now, then at zeroth order, I only have eta mu nu, g mu nu is 0, 0, satisfied trivially. Now you've went to linear order, first order. Then I said, well, you can calculate g mu nu of eta plus epsilon h up to first order. So because zeroth order was zero, then to linear order, right hand side is still zero. This will be zero. And so I'm gonna call that to first order just G linear. So we solve and then we solve this equation. And we also had the, because at linear order, this also has Bianchi identity. You have a metric, you don't have these things. The Bianchi is still satisfied on zero and first. So this thing is also, and at this order, the Bianchi becomes, because it's first order, this becomes partial derivative. And then from there, I obtained in my particular gauge H plus and H cross solutions, right? Gravitational waves. Now, let's see. Now let's go to quadratic order. So then the next order, I have to expand g mu nu to second order, which means I have to take into account this thing, right? So then there will be this, but there will be the quadratic terms in terms of what I have solved before, right? So it will be g mu nu or up of eta plus, I have to put the whole thing in, the first order solution that I found, plus the second order corrections. I just put schematically just two, all of them. So expand this out. It will be, the zeroth order is zero, so it will be some epsilon g mu nu linear term. Which we also said, again, we had when we solved it, is zero. So that also cancels out. then there will be the second order terms. One due to this, and one second order in the solution that I have just put back in my G H tab, because I solved for them, like they were the H plus and H cross, I put them there. So there would be a term that depends on call this, but it's quadratic in that. So it's of order of second order in this, plus another term, which is because in the original calculation, I should have now also be consistent and assume there are second orders in corrections to G mu, to epsilon, for example, of order of epsilon. Okay. Now, if the whole equation is satisfied at second order, then because this at zeroth order was zero, at linear order was zero, then at second order, the sum of these have to be zero as well to satisfy the equation at second order, which tells me G mu nu of H2, if I solve for it, would be negative of G mu nu of second order calculation. If I substitute HGW, my solution for a first order, I calculated it. Right. Quadratic in H plus H cross GW. Now, because I expanded this, I'm not sure this is anymore a tensor or transform as a tensor, but I got some equation that looks a lot like an Einstein equation. And so schematically, I can say, well, this correction came because of the gravitational waves that I calculated now and substituted back and went to nonlinear second order. So this, I can call it like a effective energy momentum sensor for gravitational wave. So if I remember, this is supposed to be, if I had the Einstein equation, there would sometimes be T mu nu, in this case is zero, but it's kind of seemed like I have something else on the right-hand side. And that would be, usually it was 8 pi g T mu nu, so I call this T mu nu of, let's say, gravitational waves, or effective T mu nu for my waves. Now, interestingly enough, because the Bianchi identity was satisfied here, because it's satisfied overall, it should be satisfied here too. So you can show this thing at least in the term, in terms of partial derivative. It's conserved. Because the Bianchi identity is still conserved at second order. It's not a tensor. So the thing that I define here, basically T mu nu, energy momentum tensor, effective energy momentum tensor for gravitational waves, is minus 1/8 pi g. G mu nu, you calculate your first order waves, you substitute, you know how to calculate a Einstein tensor, so put it there and calculate it, and so that's one way. You can, in the particular example we looked at yesterday when I went to the that very nice gauge when I only have h plus and h cross in a certain way. You can do this as an exercise for yourself. Yes. Oh, did it go? Better. Okay, so let's say I had one wave which was going in x direction in vacuum. So remember, I wrote a matrix for it, and I said, well, in that case, it was kind of traceless, transverse. I had two objects. I will call them now for simplicity the two H plus. The other one had to be negative of that. And H cross. The two polarizations. And now you can do my prescription here to calculate T00, T11, T01. I won't do it them, but you will see that they will, and in fact, they're all the same. The other ones are zero. So you will get second time derivative of, and as you see, obviously this is second order in your solution. Two time derivative, h dot x derivative. So if they have frequency omega, these are all of order of omega squared h squared plus or cross. Now, because if I just take it at this face value, it's oscillating a lot. So in fact, it's not quite gauge well defined and so on. It's better than you do some kind of coarse graining. Like you say, for example, in one period of the wave oscillation, how much energy is there, and average it out. It's because that's like oscillating energy density. But if you do average it over a period of the oscillation, then it becomes, in fact, for all of them, T00. I write it, but it's the same for all of them. It nicely simplifies to some h dot ij, h dot ij. Actually, I had it written, but I write it this way in the tensorial matrix form, but I can write it in terms of h plus and h cross. So this is in TT gauge, transverse traceverse. It is the same as in terms of h plus and h crosses. I think it's 1/4 pi. I picked up this last night from some Chris Hirata's notes, so there may be a mistake here, pies or stuff. So you see the two polarizations, it's kind of the time derivative squared plus it's like two amplitude. It's a little bit similar to now ENM, right? You have E squared plus B squared, and I have almost the same thing here. I have one last thing to say. Now, based on that, this is now, for example, your energy. You can calculate the energy loss. And you would have to then say, well, then I can calculate, for example, the power, how much energy in time is lost. And for that, if you have, again, some source that is emitting gravitational waves, and then you need to integrate it at far away, some infinity, So let's say gravitational waves are going in some directions, and you have some normal to this surface. Then it will be the flux integrated, flux coming out integrated on the boundary, how much energy is crossing, which would be the T 0 mu R. I have, so there will be a Rn. So n mu. Oh, and let's say this is the distance R from the center. So there will be a R squared d omega, right, integrating over the surface. So that's okay. T zero, the flux times the normal times that over the surface. And then you can show this reduces to the traceless quadratic moment. So if you subtract the trace of this from this, you get to a new quadrupole moment called IJ, which is basically the same thing minus its trace. So traceless version of quadrupole moment. And this thing then, after substituting everywhere here, simplify, we're gonna skip all the calculations, just want to give you the final answer. So it becomes related to the quadrupole moment. Hij was the two derivative of I. So it becomes, because now I have picked up another time derivative, it becomes the third time derivative of this. And hopefully by Friday we get to do in tutorial 7 some kind of at least back of the envelope calculation using this formula for a binary star that is emitting gravitational wave. Okay, I think I'll end here. Oh, one more thing that you might read in the note that I thought it was impressive. So that binary system, pulsar, that was discovered in 1976, was, if you calculate that, it's apparently 10 to the 48 watts, which I guess is very impressive. Questions? Okay, and if you wanted, my guess is, again, I have to look at the outline for the strong gravity course in April, but I'm suspecting that course will go in a more thorough way of driving these things as well. Especially in case of black holes, which are not linearized to this extent. Okay. I see you at lunch and then again at the tutorial.